The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canangla for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Indie Week. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the current issue, the July 15th issue, which is, by the way, now out on the newsstands. This lead article is called Puff Puff Pass. Everyone agrees that North Carolina's hemp industry needs to be regulated, including the hemp industry. Why can't lawmakers figure out how to do it? With time, and by the way, this is a long one, so settle in. With time running out on the General Assembly's legislative session, North Carolina's $3.2 billion hemp industry was hanging on by a thread. Businesses had already been bracing for the federal ban on intoxicating hemp that Congress passed last fall. In interviews, industry leaders professed confidence that federal lawmakers would change their minds before the law takes effect on November 12th, but their plan B was Raleigh. State regulations, they believed, could mitigate the damage. But legislation to do that had gone nowhere this year, and just before the July 4th weekend, the situation went from precarious to existential. On Thursday morning, a last-minute bill surfaced that, rather than giving the hemp industry a path forward, would codify the federal ban in state law, likely shutting down thousands of retailers and manufacturers. State Senator Bill Rabin pitched that as a feature, not a bug. Are we going to affect businesses? Yes. We're going to affect 12,000 drug dealers' businesses, Rabin said on the Senate floor on Thursday. A top lieutenant of Senate leader Phil Berger, he'd helped craft the bill. They're selling it to low-income people, to people who are down on their luck, the normal people who buy drugs, but they're also selling it to teenagers and sub-teenagers and anyone that they can prey on. A study found that there were 2,197 hemp retailers in North Carolina in 2025, though that number does not include convenience stores. An industry source said there are at most 6,000 stores that sell hemp products. Rabin's office did not respond to an email asking for the source of that figure. Rabin said he'd given up on working with the industry. Hemp leaders had claimed for years that they wanted to weed out, pardon the pun, the small minority of bad actors in their ranks and keep the public safe. He'd decided they were lying. I've had the epiphany that the big dealers and the people who want to make the money can't make the money they want to make. They can't prey upon the people whom they want to prey upon in a regulated marketplace, Rabin said. So if that's the case, we have to do away with all of it. In hemp advocates' version of events, Senate leaders had rebuffed them. There's a difference between wanting regulations and not wanting to be regulated out of business, said Huntersville-based hemp lobbyist April Byrd. The Senate voted overwhelmingly for the bill, but after a long internal meeting, House Republicans punted. It's not clear what they'll do when they reconvene at the end of July. Our caucus is looking at it, House Speaker Destin Hall told reporters on Thursday. It's a somewhat complicated bill. For now, intoxicating hemp remains unregulated in North Carolina, as the first of two parts of the Assembly's investigation have detailed. The state does not impose age restrictions, require products to be tested or have accurate labels, or ensure that they are free of bacteria and other contaminants, nor does it tax hemp the way it does alcohol and tobacco, potentially foregoing hundreds of millions in annual revenue. This free-for-all has allowed businesses to thrive, but concerns about rising cannabis-related hospital visits and deteriorating youth mental health made a crackdown seem inevitable. Since 2023, the industry has tried to head it off by lobbying for state regulations. Lawmakers agreed that rules were needed, but not what they should be. Now, the feared crackdown looms. Banning hemp won't eradicate demand. North Carolina is one of only seven states that completely prohibit recreational and medicinal cannabis. Not coincidentally, it also ranks among the country's largest markets for illicit marijuana and intoxicating hemp. A ban will push some consumers into the black market, but it won't cut off the state's cannabis supply. The Cherokee Reservation in western North Carolina has legalized marijuana, and now that Virginia's regulated market for recreational weed is ready to launch, dispensaries will likely line the border by next July. In an interview, Governor Josh Stein told the Assembly that hemp's proliferation has come with real problems. Consumers have no way to know that products are safe, and some vape shops have opened next to schools and targeted adolescents. That offends me, Stein said, but in his view, it's not an argument for a complete prohibition. Rather, he wants a regulated market that gives the state control over what's being sold and who's selling it, and not just hemp. Stein is the first North Carolina governor to call for legalizing recreational marijuana, though his preferred term is adult-use cannabis. We need to have a well-regulated market that puts public safety and public health at its center, he said. It protects kids, and it is available for adult use because adults are using it, and we can't put our heads in the sand any longer. Well, his argument has fallen on deaf ears in the legislature, where a stalemate has left hemp businesses on tenterhooks and their products entirely unchecked. Congress intended for the 2018 Farm Bill to provide consumers with access to hemp, a variety of cannabis sativa L that has 0.3% or less of the psychoactive compound Delta-9 THC, but lots of cannabidiol, or CBD, which is associated with various health benefits. But the law's definition of hemp inadvertently legalized a wide variety of THC products. Within 5 years, the hemp market has swelled more than $28 billion nationwide. Congress attempted to close that loophole last November in the late rider to must-pass legislation, redefining hemp so strictly that the new law will ban most CBD products along with intoxicating hemp. Lawmakers gave businesses a year to prepare. Well, that raises an obvious question. Since Congress has largely banned hemp, does it matter what the state does? The answer is yes, to a degree. On its own, the federal ban will radically reshape the state's hemp industry, but it probably won't put every company out of business. Products will still be legal under state law, and for the most part, state and local cops can't enforce federal statutes. Federal authorities would pose the biggest threat to retailers and producers. In theory, the feds can come down here and enforce the ban in the states and charge people with federal crimes, said Phil Dixon, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Government and an expert on cannabis law. But we haven't seen that in a long time for marijuana. For more than a decade, Congress has inserted a provision into the budget forbidding federal agencies from enforcing laws against medical marijuana in states that have legalized it, a provision that might be extended to hemp, Dixon said. Well, many companies won't take the risk, but others might, especially after investing millions of dollars in building their businesses. The industry argues that robust state regulations would help keep them afloat. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1992 that under the 10th Amendment, Congress can't intrude on state regulatory structures. This doctrine has also allowed states to legalize marijuana. Morgan Davis, a Raleigh attorney who focuses on cannabis law, said that the more structured a state system is, the more likely it is to withstand court scrutiny. Byrd told the Assembly that she thinks Congress will change its mind before the federal ban takes effect. She said hemp has become too big to ban. Quote, nationally, you're talking about $38 to $40 billion. That's a significant impact, and we're talking over 300,000 jobs. In North Carolina, the industry employs more than 16,000 people, and retail sales generate more than $1.8 billion and $88 million in sales taxes per year. President Donald Trump asked Congress to revisit the law so that Americans could access full-spectrum CBD products while preserving Congress's intent to restrict the sale of products that pose health risks. But Congress hasn't backtracked, and the lingering uncertainty added urgency to industry lobbying as the legislative session began in April. The General Assembly adopted the Farm Bill's definition of hemp in 2022 and permanently removed hemp from the state's Controlled Substances Act. A friction point emerged, however, when House Republicans spiked a Senate bill legalizing medical marijuana, a pet cause of Raybon, a cancer survivor. During the 2020 through 2023 legislative session, Byrd said hemp leaders recognized that their industry was turning into the wild, wild west and told lawmakers they wanted to help fix it. They pitched rules to protect consumers, protect our industry, and help law enforcement identify the bad actors, Byrd said. The House unanimously passed legislation from State Representative Jeffrey McNeely that included age restrictions, packaging requirements, dosing limits, and licensing rules, but the Senate added taxes and medical marijuana, a deal killer for many House Republicans. Medical marijuana remains a non-starter in the lower chamber. Some of the House members are not ready to pass a medical program because they believe that it will usher in recreational use, and that is not what the constituents in those districts want, McNeely, an Iredell County Republican, told the Assembly in an email. McNeely tried passing another version of the bill in 2025. Senator Todd Johnson, a Union County Republican, offered a similar proposal in the upper chamber, though McNeely's had stricter testing requirements and potency limits. Neither measures advanced. There's not many places you'll go anywhere and volunteer to be regulated and taxed and get turned away, Neil Orr, executive director of the industry advocacy group Cultivating Breakthroughs in Healthy Development, or CBHD, told Congress at an event in March. By last year, policy disputes had intermingled with palace intrigue. Berger was staring down a primary challenge that he would ultimately lose, and his team focused its attention on State Rep. John Bell, chair of the House's Rules Committee. Bell ran the hemp company Astera Labs, a subsidiary of a private equity firm owned by former UNC System Board of Governors chair Harry Smith, with whom Berger had a falling out. Berger operatives believed Smith was maneuvering against the Senate leader. In June of 2025, the Senate passed a bill that banned hemp products containing any cannabinoid other than Delta-9, including perhaps accidentally CBD and other non-psychoactive compounds. Bell said it would put him out of business. Bell has since left Astera, and Smith's firm has sold it. The bill languished in Bell's Rules Committee for 10 months, then, seemingly out of nowhere, House leaders brought it up for a vote in April. It was overwhelmingly rejected. The House's goal was to force the Senate into negotiations over an omnibus-style bill, Byrd said. The negotiations eventually took place, but they didn't go the way hemp supporters had hoped. This year, hemp advocates rallied behind Johnson's bill. They thought that if they could get it out of the Senate Rules Committee, both chambers would approve it. But Raybon, who chairs the committee, never brought it to a vote. Industry leaders suspected that he wouldn't do anything to help them unless medical marijuana was attached. Internal politics also played a role. Soon after Berger lost his primary in March, Johnson announced a bid to replace him as Senate leader. Berger's team is said to be more aligned with contender Mike Lee, whom Senate Republicans elevated to majority leader last year. Johnson did not respond to interview requests, by the way. But there were other reasons Johnson's bill didn't budge. Negotiations over the long-delayed budget consumed most of this session's oxygen. More importantly, some Senate Republicans didn't see a point in acting after the federal ban, a source close to Senate leaders told the Assembly. Byrd said CBHD, the advocacy group, encouraged consumers and business owners to call legislators' offices, and by early June, the industry saw movement. The bill's supporters pitched their case to the Senate GOP caucus, and advocates felt good about their chances. "We had overwhelming support in both caucuses to get hemp regs done," CBHD Vice Chair Dustin Braun said. If not Johnson's bill, Senate Republicans seemed likely to consider straightforward age restriction legislation that had already cleared the House but stalled in Raybon's committee. The legislation, Byrd said, wouldn't solve all the problems created by the federal ban, but it would be better than doing nothing. An age restriction would show that the state has the intent to regulate. Weeks passed and nothing happened. Then on June 23rd, legislative leaders received the bill the House shot down in April and sent it to a conference committee. The seven Republicans they chose to hash out a compromise between the House and Senate telegraphed the leaders' intentions. The Senate paired Berger, allies Raybon and Lee with Tom McInnes, a staunch cannabis opponent. The House's delegation, including stalwart social conservatives Neil Jackson and Donnie Loftus, along with Majority Leader Brendan Jones and Reese Pirtle. There are not members of our caucus that are generally going to be open to a really wide-open hemp industry, a source close to House leadership told the Assembly. Indeed, they weren't. Like the federal ban, their proposal prohibited any product with more than 0.4 milligrams or 0.3% of total THC, meaning not just Delta-9 but any THC, as well as products with synthetic cannabinoids. As with the federal ban, that definition would also prescribe many non-intoxicating CBD products. The bill restricted sales of the few remaining legal hemp products to people 21 and over. It also applied that age limit to kratom, a tree whose leaves can produce both stimulant and sedative effects, and banned synthetic kratom. The committee's members reached an agreement on July 1. Before noon the next day, though, it had become clear House Republicans were not on board, at least not yet. Generally, our caucus desire is to make sure that we're keeping the bad products out and not letting people under 21 buy those products, Hall said. The bill had come in late that day before, and folks basically wanted some time to be able to review it, so we'll see if it's something that we do when we come back. Three sources familiar with the situation told the Assembly that some House members worried that Raybon was using it to create a path for medical marijuana. The legislation does not directly address medical marijuana, though the issue appears to have come up during the House Republicans' meeting on Thursday morning. I know our caucus has no interest in doing any sort of marijuana, medicinal or otherwise, Hall told reporters afterward. A spokesperson said it was his most definitive statement on the issue to date. Byrd and Braun said they believe that language in the bill could potentially legalize medical marijuana if the federal government approves its use as a prescription drug. The federal government is currently reviewing marijuana's status. You would need some legislative tweaks to create a medical marijuana system once federal law changed, Byrd said, but it would move the ball in that direction. Before the Senate vote, Lee expressed disappointment in his House colleagues. We have approximately 8 overdose deaths per day, and that's a reduction off of where we are, or where we were, I should say, he said in a Senate speech. Those overdose deaths are from all narcotics, however, including fentanyl and cocaine. No fatal overdoses have been attributed solely to cannabis. That's not a mistake. The progress isn't an accident. They have the opportunity in that chamber to make the policy decision to prevent what is happening to adults and our children in North Carolina, unquote. Well, the General Assembly is scheduled to return the week of July 27th. The hemp industry will likely mount a full court press before then. CBHD released an ad before the Senate vote attacking McInnis as a rhino, or Republican in name only. The ad, which has since been taken down, accused the Moore County conservative of opposing Trump's efforts to fix our economy and keep North Carolina's hemp industry strong. On the surface, targeting McInnis made little sense. McInnis was reelected in 2024 with 63% of the vote. Senate Democrats don't see him as vulnerable this year, going after Lee, who is both in a swing district in North Hanover, make that New Hanover County, and seeking a leadership post would seem more logical. Braun said CBHD definitely had some strategy around Lee, adding that the group wants his district to understand that he is very positive toward hemp at the beginning of the year, saw it as an economic boom, and now he's completely flipped to just ban it all. But Braun said his group believed McInnis, a MAGA loyalist, would freak out at being called a rhino and cause a huge amount of conversation and ruckus. McInnis is also a close ally of Raybon, which CBHD saw as icing on the cake. The thought was, instead of poking Raybon right between the eyes and potentially making matters worse, McInnis was a better option, Braun said. And it worked. Braun said CBHD is just getting started. We have tried the nice way. We have tried and tried and tried to make friends and to incentivize and to become educators and to give the optics of the industry that, yes, we 100% agree, we want the bad actors out too, but that has gotten us nowhere except spit in the face. Stein was attorney general when hemp became ubiquitous and when a vape shop opened near his kid's high school, but he realized that as long as these products remained unregulated, he was powerless to stop their sales to minors. He was also determined that trying to regulate hemp products differently from marijuana had become a fool's errand. There actually used to be a distinction in the law, Stein said. The two plants, naturally grown, had different THC levels. You'd smoke hemp, it would take a whole lot to get you high, and it might not. Once hemp was legalized, both growers and sellers realized you could genetically modify hemp plants and increase the level of THC. Cannabis is cannabis, he said. It doesn't make sense to try to distinguish between two varieties of the same plant. And what we really care about is this product going to get you high or not? That's why we must regulate the THC molecule. Several experts the assembly interviewed for this series agreed with that sentiment. One major challenge for state regulators across the country has been managing multiple regulatory models for essentially the same products. Cannabis Regulators Association Executive Director Jillian Schauer wrote in an email, for example, when states have one set of regulations for a 100 milligram THC brownie made from hemp and another set of regulations for a 100 milligram THC brownie made from marijuana, it can complicate regulatory implementation and leave regulatory gaps. Berger, the Senate leader, expressed a similar thought last week. The problem we have is that while we don't have recreational marijuana, we don't have medical marijuana, what we have are products that, for all practical purposes, have the same effect on people, and they're totally unregulated. Berger's solution was to ban all of it. Stein argues that crackdowns are futile and fly in the face of increasing public support for legalization. A regulated market, he said, allows the state to protect consumers from harmful products and keep children safe. The degree to which legalizing cannabis would protect young people isn't clear. Studies indicate that adolescents don't use cannabis more than states legalize marijuana. After states legalize marijuana and recreational weed doesn't lead to more substance use overall, use has, however, increased among young adults ages 18 to 25. Legalization has also been associated with more impaired driving and cannabis-related hospital visits. Last June, Stein convened an advisory council to figure out what a regulated cannabis market should look like. The council, consisting of more than two dozen lawmakers, health and law enforcement officials, and cannabis industry representatives, issued a preliminary report in early April. Despite media reports, the report didn't call for legalizing marijuana. It said that was the General Assembly's decision. The council's task was to figure out a framework if lawmakers went that route. But the report strongly implied that the legislature didn't have much of a choice. The question is whether the General Assembly will allow intoxicating products to continue to be sold without enforceable state standards, or whether it will establish a regulatory system designed to protect public health and public safety. An adult access market with protections for medical consumers, in which cannabis is purchased through state licensed retailers, offered the greatest revenue potential while addressing regulatory gaps, the report argued. A legal market would also avoid the red tape and loopholes inherent to medical marijuana programs. The council is supposed to issue a final report in December. Its preliminary recommendations received a cool reception from some Republicans. It's remarkable that we're going to put money into psychosis treatment and opioid treatment at the same time we have a report out that is trying to legalize marijuana, State Rep. Timothy Reeder, an emergency physician from Pitt County and chair of the House's Health Care Committee, said during a hearing. Stein acknowledged that reform won't be easy, but he thinks it's a matter of when, not if. People change, Stein said. Society changes. I can remember when you couldn't buy alcohol here in the supermarket on a Sunday, and you couldn't buy wine in a supermarket at all, and you couldn't get mixed drinks in the majority of the counties in North Carolina. What I'm trying to do is advance the conversation. Braunz, the CBHD vice chair, said there's not a snowball's chance in hell that Stein will sign the hemp ban if the House passes it. He's been very pro-hemp, very pro-marijuana since the day he took office. Byrd, the lobbyist, wasn't so sure, and the governor's office didn't comment on his plans. Regardless, the state's hemp industry is not likely to accept whatever lawmakers do or don't do this year as the final word. By next year, the House could have more cannabis-friendly members, and they might have a perceived ally at the state's helm if Johnson wins the leadership role. The article goes on, and on. Advocates also believe the public supports them. In late April, CBHD released a survey from Republican operative Paul Shoemaker that found that 63% of North Carolina voters supported legislation to allow the state-regulated sale of hemp-derived consumable products. Time might be on their side in Washington, D.C. as well, with Democrats expected to make big gains this fall. But for now, hemp businesses are awash in uncertainty. "It just doesn't seem fair," said Sean Stokes, owner of Hops and Flower in Durham. Stokes opened his shop in January, but his venture had been in the works for well over a year. He'd taken out $150,000 in loans and signed a 5-year, $8,000 a month lease last September. His store also sells coffee and sandwiches, but cannabis products account for about half of its revenue, Stokes said. "Now a federal ban on those products looms, and I don't see how I can make it work," he said. Stokes said the demand is obvious. "The space has gotten really crowded in just the last year. The number of shops out there has increased substantially." Stokes said, if anything, the legal uncertainty is holding more back. There's still so much confusion in the marketplace among consumers. Stokes hopes Congress changes course. If not, he said, the best-case scenario is a regulated state market that prohibits ingredients that shouldn't be in the products and instills trust and confidence in the people. The problem is, to do that, you have to concede that everything we're selling is exactly the same thing as what we would be selling in a recreational cannabis state, Stokes said. It's all just semantics. Still with me? Well, that article took half of the newscast, so let's find a few others that are a little shorter. This one's interesting. We're going to go to Apex next. This article is entitled "Fighting the Perception." Apex wants you to know its downtown businesses are open. The Salem Streetscape Project aims to make the main downtown thoroughfare more pedestrian-friendly, but recently construction has discouraged foot traffic, leaving some businesses facing dipping sales. Textile artist Cynthia Mollenkopf has owned and operated the Cocoon Gallery on downtown Apex's main thoroughfare since 2017. She knows that running a North Salem Street storefront means there's often change. Cocoon Gallery supports a revolving door of 70 to 80 artists. Mollenkopf said, selling to customers who happen past the store or purchase online. Larger-than-life felt creations and colorful rugs hang in the space, bathed in natural light. Little trinkets and treasures sit on shelves you have to be careful not to bump into. Mollenkopf is also involved in the ever-shifting small business ecosystem that defines downtown. She has given input on several major development decisions, witnessed storefront turnover, and keeps up with her neighbors. She knew the Salem Streetscape Project, a reimagined pedestrian-centric version of the street with origins dating to 2019, was coming, and the construction could cause foot traffic to taper, leading in-store sales to decline, but Mollenkopf was excited for the finished product. "What we didn't expect is that the landlords were then going to raise the rent," she said. Mollenkopf said her store's rent will increase, though that was not comfortable sharing by how much, and she thinks her downstairs, upstairs, and next-door neighbors' rents will either also go up or already have. "It's hard to reconcile the strain with the construction, which she estimates brought her sales down about 10%. Many business owners along North Salem say they are seeing decreased foot traffic, and for restaurants, outdoor dining can be less desirable amid loud and dusty construction work, leading sales to dip and business owners to hunker down. The thing is, no businesses or sidewalks are actually closed. We're really fighting a perception of downtown not being open, because if you go downtown, you can get into every business," town manager Randy Vosberg told the Indy. "The sidewalks are open. The road is open with traffic flow. We've got plenty of parking." Apex's downtown district is mainly lined with the facades of small local businesses set into brick-and-mortar buildings whose roots date to the 1910s. The downtown thoroughfare is quaint, familiar, and lively. Most businesses are small gift and oddity shops or mom-and-pop restaurants and breweries that stay afloat of passerby curiosity, local word of mouth, and their collective presence. The roughly $4.7 million Salem Streetscape Project, which broke ground in January, aims to transform the North Salem Street into a destination that centers a walkability and outdoor dining by adding staggered parallel parking, widened paver sidewalks, urban street trees, decorative light poles, string lighting, planter boxes, wayfinding signs, street furniture, and so much more, according to Apex's website. During the construction, the town has shut down a portion of the east side of North Salem Street to northbound traffic, which Vosburgh projected will commence later this month before it swaps to the west side. Orange and white traffic cones, barricades, and tape surrounding the road as construction workers hack away at widening the sidewalks, remodeling a stretch of the road into a brick herringbone pattern, installing trench drains, and adding underground soil cells to support new American elm trees. Originally set to commence in October, the town projects an end date for the project as early as November or as late as January of 2027 after revised electrical plans caused an unforeseen delay which slowed work in March and April. In addition to declining sales and rent hikes, businesses are struggling to break even due to an omnishambles of concurrent property tax increases, rising insurance rates, and inflated supply costs. Those who haven't already made tough calls anticipate they'll soon have to. Alexis Jensen, who owns the gift shop North Left Mercantile, with her husband Leif, said they have seen about a 30% decrease in sales since January. They opened an online store, expanded their operating hours, and invested more in marketing to prepare for the long haul, she said. While Laura Garenser, owner of gift shop and craft space Adventures in Bloom, is newer to the street, she estimates about a 15% decrease compared to before construction started. She told the Indy that it was a bit of a gut punch to hear the project would extend into the holiday season when they expect the bulk of their sales. Wayne and Christina Alcade, who own farm-to-fork restaurant The Provincial, said they've accepted what they are not making money this year, solely aiming to break even. Wayne Alcade said they don't want to place the burden of rising costs and decreased sales on their employees and have still been giving raises. He said, if we didn't lose money, then it's a win, right? Because everybody knew that revenue was going to go down, but the costs haven't gone down right now. Utilities, taxes, payroll all go up, and then that doesn't pause for a streetscape or downturn in the economy. Alleyway Bookstore already announced its closure in a social media post last month, citing a 64% rent hike and other pressures, including the streetscape's construction. Anna's Pizzeria told WRAL they've also seen about 10 to 20% decrease in sales and are cutting employees' shifts. And Apex Mayor Jacques Gilbert featured Gabrielle Carlin, owner of Bella Plus Mauve, in a social media video and said the boutique may have to make difficult decisions due to economic pressures. He encouraged people to shop in the district. The owners of Alleyway Bookstore, Anna's Pizzeria, and Bella Plus Mauve did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. For all the downsides of the construction, downtown Apex business owners told the Indy that the broader public perception of the project is misguided. Despite the short-term profit losses, many said they see it as a long-term investment and are excited that the project will make their businesses more attractive. Jensen said it was a big reason she and her husband signed their most recent lease. We wanted to get it in at this price and establish our business and get the roots that we needed, knowing that this is going to be a destination at that point. Jensen said, and that means that we pay for destination pricing, and that's an investment for us and our business, so we're prepared for that. Bolenkoff, the owner of Cocoon Gallery, said, another common misperception is that the project was a surprise. In fact, downtown business owners, including Mullenkoff, have been involved from the start. The Salem Streetscape vision went back to a downtown design plan that took shape throughout 2019 with the help of a steering committee that included Jensen and other business owners. Designs saw revisions with broader input from the community, including focus groups, public workshops, a survey, and meetings with downtown tenants and property owners per Apex's website, mostly until 2021. It's one of the three main projects in the downtown plan, along with the recently completed Saunders parking lot expansion that added 152 spaces to the area, and the soon-to-come Alleys and Peak gathering space. Molnikoff said most downtown businesses were willing to suffer through the construction, hoping they would make up for losses when the area had that destination feel. We also knew that the downtown businesses were seeing a year-over-year decline in sales, and so this was part of a let's get the downtown modernized to help everybody out. While the town doesn't want to minimize the experiencing of struggling businesses and business owners, Apex Director for Economic Development, Joanna Helms, told the Indy, they have seen businesses downtown and across Apex thriving, too. Of the businesses seeing sales increase, she added that construction might not be entirely to blame as much as other simultaneous pressures. We have some businesses that have seen significant decreases. We have seen, they said, things are still the same. We have some that said, hey, I had my busiest month last month. Not everyone has seen rent increases either, and multiple business owners told the Indy they have good working relationships with their landlords. Garrison said she sees them as small business owners who are also facing economic pressures. Helms said downtown business owners have told town leadership that they want them to speak positively about downtown Apex to again fight the perception that it's closed and unwelcoming during construction. Business owners the Indy spoke to credited the town for spreading the word that businesses are indeed open and encouraging consumers to shop small. Two banners hang over the road at each end of the North Salem Street thoroughfare that read, Downtown Apex is open for business. Encouraging street signs are placed throughout sidewalks, and Vosburgh and Helms emphasize the town has ramped up its online communications. While some scoff at Apex Mayor Jacques Gilbert's ubiquitous social media presence, downtown business owners also said they appreciated his posts spotlighting small businesses and informing the public of the construction project's progress. Wayne Alcade said he has heard from restaurant guests that Gilbert's videos motivated their visit to downtown, even coming from towns over. With the project's end date teetering into the holiday season when sales usually peak, business owners told the Indy they are bracing for losses. To bring in foot traffic and maintain a sense of normalcy, Vosburgh said the town hopes to host a modified Christmas parade, perhaps with smaller floats to squeeze down the one-way street. Business owners and town leaders both acknowledge the storefronts that line the thoroughfare could look different when construction wraps, whether due to a decreased businesses from the project, regular turnover exacerbated by economic pressures, the finished project attracting new and perhaps larger businesses, or all of the above. But many businesses are sure they will make it through and excited to become part of a livelier commerce hub, even if some anticipate a potential catch, their rents going up accordingly. Everyone's feeling the impact of it, and we're all going to have a huge sigh of relief when we get through to the other side, Jensen said. I feel firmly that we will all celebrate this at the end and that our businesses will benefit from it, but I do wish people understand that this was a response to something, and hopefully we'll all be here on the other side. And now news of another project, kind of motivated by demand and resulting in some construction, and it will be a while before it's finished, but a lot of folks feel that it'll really be terrific when it's finally done. What am I talking about? A new DIY skate park is coming to JC Park in Raleigh. Following the demolition of Gradeside DIY, Raleigh skaters work with the city on what will be a community-built skate park in the public park. When Gradeside DIY, a community-built skate park located on a privately owned lot in southwest Raleigh, was demolished in 2025, the skaters who made it a community felt lost. Oops, sorry. We feel like we've been wandering in the desert this past year, said Aaron Collins, who helped build many of the ramps at Gradeside. It's been awful, but finally we'll be able to build a Raleigh skate park. In March 2025, Collins and some other skateboarders approached the Raleigh City Council to ask them to help them find a new place where they could build a city-sanctioned skate park. Council members were on board, so to speak, and connected them with city staff members who could help. After working with the city's Parks and Recreation Department over the past year, the skaters' request has, in fact, become a reality. There's an agreement in place the city's confirmed, and construction is expected to begin on a new DIY skate park in JC Park on a site that formerly stored dumpsters late this summer. Raleigh Parks is excited to collaborate with another community-based skate group, said Stephen Bentley, the city's parks director, in an email. Partnerships like this create greater opportunities for skateboarding, roller skating, and other wheeled opportunities in the city. Been a long journey to get here. Gradeside DIY started out as a closely guarded secret back in 2016. A concrete and asphalt 13-acre plot of land surrounded by woods, a creek, and an old cemetery just south of Tryon Road. The city became a free-for-all during the pandemic years as more and more skaters used it and built more and more obstacles and ramps. Before it was demolished, Graveside DIY featured a 6-foot-tall ramp known as Punk Wall, a rainbow coping quarter pipe, and a loop. At the end of 2024, the Islamic Association of Raleigh, the property's owner, sold it to a developer to build townhouses. Skate park was demolished soon after. Many of the Graveside crew and other local skateboarders wanted to find a permanent space and a way to try to recapture some of Graveside DIY's magic. Following their public comments to the Raleigh City Council, Paul Thompson, a longtime skateboarder who grew up in Raleigh, took the lead on the conversations with city officials. The Skaters Incorporated, as a nonprofit, East Coast DIY Skate Park Foundation, and met with parks staff to figure out site and insurance logistics. The group will submit drawings to the city, and once they're approved, and once the nonprofit raises enough money, construction on the skate park can begin. The whole city council just got behind it and put us in touch with the right people, and they're all for it, Thompson said. It feels good to partner with somebody that you feel like you can have a comfortable relationship with. Collins and Thompson said the group needs to raise money to buy tools and construction materials, and they're in need of a shipping container for storage during the building process. There's currently a GoFundMe with a goal of $40,000 for the first phase of the skate park, and the group is accepting material and other donations. The final result will be a DIY skate park that everyone can use, with everything from features for beginners to more challenging features for more advanced skaters. It will be lit at night to stay open in line with the park's hours. Most importantly, and unlike Graveside DIY and other DIY spots that have come and gone over the years, the JC DIY State Park will be permanent. We've always had revolving doors on these DIY spots, like all over the place. As Thompson said, there used to be one on NC State's campus. There was one out in Chapel Hill on some tennis courts. There was one at the old prison that was right next to the art museum. They've been all over, and they always get torn down. So I've just been frustrated not knowing and not having that. We need something for the future generations of skateboarders. We move on now to a story headlined, Wake County Introduces Initiative to Move 400 People Living in Encampments into Permanent Housing. Over the next 18 months, the plan called Wake at Home will provide funds to help move people into housing at a total cost of $22 million. Wake County Initiative announced Monday sets an ambitious goal of moving 400 people from homeless encampments into housing in the next 18 months. Led by the Wake County Continuum of Care, or the COC, the county's umbrella organization for homeless services, with help from local government and private sector partners, the plan involves closing encampments across the county and offering their residents a year of housing, behavioral health, and workforce assistance to transition them out of homelessness. Some details of the plan, such as where the money will come from and when the first encampments will be decommissioned, are not yet public. The plan, called Wake at Home, strikes a balance between recognizing the humanity of people experiencing homelessness and responding to the concerns of the broader community, according to a press release from the COC. It comes on the heels of Governor Joss Stein's veto of an unrelated, according to the county, bill banning unauthorized camping, which seems likely to be overridden. Fueled by an acute housing shortage and affordability crisis, homelessness in Wake County has spiked in recent years. A 2026 survey counted 1,150 homeless people in Raleigh and the surrounding towns, up from 769 in 2020. By contrast, there are only about 600 beds across the county's overnight shelters, leaving hundreds of people sleeping in cars, on couches, in jails and hospitals, on the street or in tents every night. According to Eileen Rosa, director of the COC, Wake at Home takes a direct-to-housing approach to resolving homelessness, recognizing that we might not have enough immediately available shelter or even vouchers available. Rosa said closing encampments alone does not solve homelessness, but providing resources to unhoused people can. She pointed to similar initiatives in Dallas, Tulsa, Denver, and New Orleans. Dallas announced it had effectively ended downtown homelessness in May of 2025 after launching a program through its own continuum of care that paired strict enforcement of a street sleeping ban with wraparound social services and housing assistance. Denver and Tulsa also reportedly enforce outdoor sleeping bans as part of their initiatives to end unsheltered homelessness. Wake at Home is expected to cost $22 million over the next 18 months, Rosa said. On an individual level, she estimated a year of rental assistance and supportive services would cost around $24,000 per household per year. For comparison, one study found that a chronically homeless person costs taxpayers $35,000 per year on average in crisis services, law enforcement, hospitalizations, and encampment cleanups. Rosa said the COC has already identified some well-known encampments that will be targeted for the Wake at Home initiative and begun some work, though she declined to name specific locations or go into further detail. We can't necessarily be specific about sites or things like that, but there is some work underway. Rosa said the COC and its partners are actively fundraising and will begin gradually clearing encampments and moving people into housing as funding becomes available. We can't necessarily identify some of the private partners just yet, but that funding framework is underway. Once the residents of a camp are housed, the COC and its partners will monitor the area to prevent encampments from returning to those sites, according to the press release. Some people experiencing homelessness are also navigating mental and physical health conditions or addiction. They may have criminal records that affect their ability to find housing and work, Rosa said. Wake at Home is aiming to be as low barrier as possible and will offer health care and employment services alongside its housing assistance to accommodate those situations. The amount of assistance will taper as the year ends, Rosa said, so that people become progressively more independent rather than the COC abruptly cutting off all support. Rosa didn't seem concerned about finding 400 housing units for people to live in. She said program participants will be able to use the housing assistance anywhere in Wake County or even outside of the county if they prefer. It's not that we necessarily need 400 units today, she said, referencing the plan to fold people into the program incrementally. Homeless encampments can be unsafe and an eyesore, but they can also offer stability and community to people who would otherwise be out on their own. Some people spend years living in the same encampment, building a life there complete with possessions, pets, and friends. Even though living outside is grueling, they may be loath to leave, particularly if they've had bad experiences with service providers in the past. Rosa acknowledged that not everyone will want to accept the COC's assistance. If the answer is no at first, it does not mean no forever, she said. I think that we have to prove to some people who may have been distracting in the past or distrusting in the past that resources really have improved. Most of the $22 million for Wake at Home will go toward housing those 400 people, according to Rosa, but a smaller chunk will be set aside for rapid one-time housing assistance for people experiencing homelessness for the first time. Rosa said some people just need help with a security deposit or a one-time rental payment to quickly return to housing. This part of the initiative is an extension of Wake County's existing Bridge to Home program, which has already helped more than 3,000 people. Wake at Home aims to help another 1,000 over the next 18 months. Homelessness policy has been in the news recently in connection to a House Bill 437, an unfunded mandate which would ban camping on public property outside of specially designated areas. Critics believe the bill doesn't address root causes of homelessness and overburdens local governments. Stein vetoed it last week, but the state House and Senate seem to have enough votes from Republicans and a smattering of Democrats and unaffiliated legislators to override his veto when they return to session at the end of the month. Wake at Home has been in development for months and is not an answer to HB 437, Rosa said. Regardless of the legislation, we would be advancing this initiative and advancing our shared goal as a community to end homelessness. And now let's go over to Durham, where new zoning for East Durham's Garland District could transform the historic neighborhood. Developers with ties to the neighborhood have plans to turn the Angier Driver Corridor into a mini downtown. Old East Durham has a long history as an industrial hub, but some property owners in the area want to further transform the district into a residential and commercial destination. Currently, the district is sliced up by incongruent zoning types. A significant portion of the area is still zoned for industrial uses, even as the neighborhood has slowly reconstituted to include more houses and small businesses. A group of residential and commercial property owners want to turn two blocks around the Angier Driver Corridor into a, quote, downtown area, complete with retail, maker spaces, restaurants, and a variety of housing options. No specific plans have been filed, and any changes are likely still years away, as the city makes improvements to the area's sewer system, which is currently at capacity, putting additional growth there on hold. The proposal took an initial step on June 15th, when the Durham City Council approved the necessary rezoning by a 5-2 vote. In Durham's earliest incarnation, the district played host to the Durham Cotton Manufacturing Company, whose headquarters at the end of Driver Street is now occupied by chemical distributor Brenntag. The neighborhood surrounding the mill rapidly expanded to include housing, banks, and churches like the former Angier Avenue Baptist Church that sprung up at that time. Decades after the mills closed, the industrial zoning lent itself to automotive shops, scrap yards, and crematoriums. In the early 2000s, as Durham began its economic rebound and downtown became oversaturated, folks took chances on cheaper spaces on the periphery of Main Street. Black entrepreneurs, in particular, coalesced around the historic Old East Durham neighborhood as a spiritual successor to Durham's Black Wall Street. But the current hodgepodge of zoning types limits development permitted in the area through an ordinance feature called nonconformity. Any changes to properties that don't conform to the current zoning rules, in this case, homes and businesses in the industrial zoning area, are prohibited. The rezoning effort is led by Garland Ventures, a group of local developers with a history of rehabilitating former industrial sites in Durham. John Warasila, one of the partners in Garland Ventures, said the owners of all the properties that will be rezoned opted to be included. Properties whose owners did not want to participate aren't. About 24 residential and commercial properties are included in the re-envisioned district. Garland Ventures owns 6, with 2 more under Warasila's name. "We are not some big out-of-town developer who's come in to try and rebuild an entire part of the city," Warasila said at a previous city council meeting. "We're local people who are working from the ground up to revitalize neighborhoods that have seen no improvement for decades." Warasila moved to Durham in the 90s and lives downtown. His firm, Alliance Architecture, is responsible for rehabilitating other former industrial centers like Golden Belt and American Tobacco Campus. "When we looked at East Durham, we said this is distinctly not a downtown," Warasila said. "It's a very different scale of development, 2- and 3-story buildings, where the commercial is on the ground floor and residential is a floor or two above that, but not 5 stories. The trade-off is that scale versus building big parking lots. The goal is to bring more foot traffic to the commercial corridor, providing a stronger customer base for the businesses in the area." Dan Jewell, who has been working as a developer in Durham for nearly 40 years and is also involved in the Garland rezoning, said at the meeting, quote, "In talking to those people, the tenants, our tenants, and other folks in the neighborhood, it's clear what is needed is a lot more local foot traffic than is in there today to support these businesses," Jewell told the council. "We can't do that with the current light industrial zoning." The city began exploring options for rezoning the district several years ago. Business owners like Joe Bushfan, who opened his restaurant-turned-commissary kitchen Joe's Diner in 2010, told The Indian in 2017 that the city had long neglected the district. Durham made some investments in the neighborhood. In 2013, the city spent $4.8 million on improvements to the streets, sidewalks, and utilities in the corridor. Popular businesses like Proximity Brewing, Rauf Hewa Book Cafe, Mike D's BBQ, and Ideals Sandwich Shop filled the vacant mill houses and empty commercial spaces soon after. The district has been moderately successful, building momentum in fits and starts. Rauf Hewa, Proximity Brewing, and Mike D's recently closed their storefronts for varying reasons, but Dame's Chicken and Waffles relocated to the corridor late last year, and Ideals keeps a line around the block most days. The neighborhood also includes a couple of bars, a home goods store, a small grocery, and other retail options. It's also poised for growth. Another project, Brickworks, will substantially increase the population of the area. Durham Technical Community College is building housing not far from the proposed Garland District, and the city is exploring options for a transit substation nearby in the Village Shopping Center. Jewel and Warasilla worked to restore the old Garland Woodcraft building where Dames is now after a major fire caused structural collapse years ago. The building is part of the East Durham Historic District the city created in 2004, and Jewel said it won't be demolished as part of future plans for the area. At the June 15th meeting, the City Council approved changing the Garland District property zoning from industrial light to, quote, commercial general and commercial infill. The City Planning Department created the Commercial Infill Zoning District in 2018 to accommodate and encourage smaller-scale development. The designation has been used sparingly. West Chapel Hill Street is the most prominent example, but the zoning does pave the way for future projects in areas like the Angier Driver Corridor. Council members Shanetta Burris and Nate Baker voiced concerns about the proposed rezoning, citing environmental concerns and the lack of specific plans for the area. Burris pressed the developers on their plans for some of the industrial sites that might have contaminants in the land, as well as any contingency plans for any accidents on the railroad tracks that might affect the new residents Garland District is expected to host. Brentag, a chemical distribution company whose facility is across the railroad tracks on the other side of Peabody Street, is currently being sued for polluting a nearby creek. Jewel said Garland Ventures would work with Durham Fire Department to understand what contingency plans are already in place and take additional steps if needed. Baker, along with Councilmember Chelsea Cook, who both voted against rezoning, raised concerns about approving the zoning change without a specific plan for the area in hand. Baker questioned whether waiting for the city to adopt new land use rules would give city council, the planning department, and the neighborhood time to think about the area more holistically and possibly create a small area plan for the Garland District. Because the case is for rezoning without a specific development plan, Baker said the city is missing out on the opportunity to receive additional proffers from the applicants. The new zoning would allow future development by right without the applicants having to come back to City Council for further approval, precluding the city from negotiating proffers like affordable housing or donations to public schools based on the impact of the project. Could we work on commitments that involve community investment, public investments, and infrastructure so that both private investments and public investments are greater than the sum of the parts? Baker said. Jewel said that the uncertainty around Durham's future land use rules and the sewer capacity issues in Durham, East Durham, as well as the lengthy development process, the Garland team wants to get out in front of any potential plans for the district as soon as possible. Well, just about run out of time for today's episode of Indie Week. Hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Chris Canangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Indie Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.